We met before the concert either, Joe Hudson. Okay, hi, I'm Joe Hudson. I'm not Preston Trombley still. I'm still not Preston Trombley, but I'm hoping to turn into him at some point. This is Alec Hall and Carl Schimmel, and they have written the two pieces on our second half. And I guess, Alec, we'll start with you. Is there, this is a very evocative title, Hendrik Lorentz stares into the Bava
Kakra. Yeah. I wouldn't have chosen evocative. I was maybe opaque.
Well, it could be, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. It's evocative until it becomes opaque because, one wonders what it means. Why Hendrik Lorentz?
It's from he's a physicist in the early 20th century.
Right, sort of worked with Einstein and didn't get very much credit.
Yeah, so I was looking for something to describe the formal process of the work after I'd completed it. And basically, there's a thing called the Lorentz transformation, and if you look at it, it's visualized really beautifully. And it kind of sums up the form of the piece, and you basically have a kind of, I'm not a physicist.
Right.
But it made sense when I saw it. And the Bava Kakra is the Buddhist wheel of life, which is a constantly circling motion of change, but.
It's a rather, the actual depiction of it is, it's both sublime and also very kind of horrible. There's some horrible images in it too. Really,
that's right.
Really grotesque.
Of course.
Scary.
Yeah.
But also sublime.
Yeah, well,
it's the wheel of life.
It's the wheel of life. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, this piece is, as you can read in the program notes, was inspired by a very particular moment, I suppose, with my friend Taylor. But I should say that it's actually, so that was in 2008, I think,
mm-hmm.
2008, beginning of 2008, that moment, and in the Mojave National Preserve at around 5 a.m., after being awake for a very long time. And anyway, so that this is the time period in which I'm dealing with, and I think that the work expresses a kind of, it's definitely parenthetical in the sense that it's no longer representative of anything that I work on today or what I'm interested in at all. This was a kind of end point of the study of looking for functional microtonal progressions and a search for a kind of expression of formal clarity. And so it started at the end of my undergraduate work at McGill, and then this was a kind of full expression of my master's studies at UC San Diego in the very beginning of my doctorate at Columbia, where I then started looking at different things. And so it's interesting to see this work now, like 3.5 years later. I composed it when I was 25 and I was studying with Tristan Murai, and I hear, some of the harmonies, I'm thinking like, wow, those are amazing chords for the piano, and then I hear another one and I totally cringe, and I'm thinking like, oh my God, I would actually do something like that. So it's a moment in time that expresses a kind of sought after series of musical expressions and intellectual demands.
Well, it's a very effective piece. I've listened to it a couple times, and it's rather difficult.
It's extremely difficult.
Extremely difficult,
yeah.
And really a beautiful piece.
Thanks.
Carl, we have more arcana here. We're getting more and more arcane. We have the Bava Kakra. I can't really say that. And now we have the Pismirist's Congeries.
Right.
Now, I've looked up Pismirist, and I don't see that Pismirist is a word that's very... Pismir,
yeah,
is means ant piss. That's,
oh,
the,
okay.
That's the derivation of Pismir.
That I didn't know.
Because, it's a little... people, we say this in English. What a little piss-ass detail,
mm-hmm.
Or ass-piss detail. But that's the derivation I was able to find. But Pismirist, I couldn't find it in the dictionary. Is this a word of your old English or something?
Well, Pismirist, so I have kind of an interest in obscure words, maybe in part because, language is obviously supposed to convey meaning and connect you to someone else perhaps, but to then deliberately use an obscure word is kind of undermining the very nature of language in a way. So that just fascinates me. So I found there's a website online that's a large collection of these obscure words. And so I just kind of hunted through them until I found words that I thought were kind of interesting and were about something that I hadn't thought about before, maybe. Or so anyway, Pismarism was on there.
Pismarism, the whole
Pismarist.
The movement of people who are Pismarists,
people who
collect Pismir.
Yeah, little small things.
Wow. Okay.
Or insignificant.
These are
more like small things. Maybe.
Right. But they're also beautiful words.
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic. Can you explain what all these things are?
Yeah. So I'm glad that the program was done in a thorough way, because this way you get to read about what the different things are and also the different titles of the movements. Sometimes that doesn't always happen in a performance of this piece. So I guess I would like to point out something that is already pointed out for you in the program notes, which is that several of these movements, most of the movements, run together. So it will be difficult for you to know for sure, unless I shout out that another next movement has started or something, which I won't do.
You could just raise one finger suddenly.
Right. Maybe I can ask the other Carl to do that. But the first three are separate, and maybe a little bit longer. The fourth, the one about the bird song, I think will be, it will be apparent because it'll be after several pauses, but hopefully you can kind of hear the bird song. I wrote the piece for a friend from Japan, a flutist from Japan, and so the bird song I used is the Japanese bush warbler song, which is maybe revered or something. I mean, it's a very special song that is used a lot. If you watch Japanese film at all, like, you would probably have heard it. It's used in the backgrounds of Japanese film a lot. Very Japanese, kind of associated with the Japanese culture, I guess. So I use that in that fourth movement. And then the fifth movement is the pianist finger exercise machine. You can probably tell what is going on in Edith's hands at that moment. It's quite difficult. And then the rest kind of all runs together, unfortunately. But I'll mention that the Thaumaturgia and the Greek censer is where things slow down and there's a lot of sliding around.
Yes. Well, I didn't have this breakdown, and I actually I don't know what I had when I was listening to the piece, but there is this really a sense of kind of incantation almost to me, a very magical kind of incanting kind of feeling to a lot of the beginning, especially of the piece, and it's very just wonderful, very very nice. Very nice. If anybody has any questions or yes, Eric.
Alec Hall said something very interesting. Functional microtonal progression, modulations?
Progressions.
Progressions. Can you explain that, please?
So when I got to Columbia, there was Fred Lairdell, who's on an honorary member of the board here. He teaches there, and some of you may know some of his books, Generative Theory of Tonal Music, and then more importantly, the second one is Tonal Pitch Space. And in Tonal Pitch Space, he posits five levels of functional pitch space. And in my first year there, we were working together in a cognitive constraints class. And I said to him, I was like, let's posit a hypothetical sixth level, which would be smaller than the semitone, so let's say quarter tones, because that's how they're divided, octaves, fifths.
Right.
Is that right? Going smaller and smaller and smaller. And it's to the point where it's only hypothetically possible. Like, it's not even theoretically possible, because it is a theory itself, but the theory only half works. So this idea of looking for functional progressions would be a sense of kind of, could we keep some kind of root motion? How do these, in a kind of psychoacoustic kind of way, can we create a listening grammar of expectation, cadence, I'm blanking on it.
Hierarchy,
but no, sorry. With Schenker, you have two fundamental motions. Prolongation.
Prolongation.
That's right.
Okay.
A sense of microtonal prolongation and then resolution. And I think in the sense that it works hypothetically, it works. And, you know, a lot of things that only half theoretically work also work really well in reality. So I think that I'm satisfied with it in the piece, but...
And you explored that in this piece?
Yeah, I explored it down to the eighth tone level, And but it's different from, say, Taylor's work, which is based on a lot on just intonation, or Ryan over here, who works a lot with spectras, and it's this was much more sort of like classical harmonic progression, but let's taking it into like a deeper microtonal level.
Okay, I'm glad you asked that question, but I was sort of going to avoid asking that question. Or actually, maybe I was just going to pretend I understood what he was saying. Oh yes, functional microtonal progressions.
Well, you'll hear that the multiphonics on the clarinet were recorded in advance, and they formed the harmonic progression, which is essentially a chaconne, and then the piano's chords are equal temperament approximations of it.
Oh.
So that's something to listen for.
Okay. All right, let's have at it.